is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 53 was recorded on March 9th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. The big story this week in markets was the massive sell-off in crude oil. So we're bringing back petroleum geologist Art Berman, one of our most popular guests, for this week's featured interview. Art and I will discuss the OPEC agreement, record speculative long interest in crude oil futures, long-term viability of the Bakken and other U.S. shale plays, comparative inventory data, and much, much more. Art sent us a slide deck to accompany this interview, and I strongly recommend that you download it before listening, as Art will be referring to the graphs and charts that it contains throughout the interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email, and if you haven't registered yet, Patrick will tell you how to get the download before the interview starts.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Before continuing, I want to let all our listeners know that we've taped this several hours earlier this week. It's about 11 a.m. Eastern time on Thursday rather than our usual 4 p.m. after the markets close. So that means the commentary won't include Thursday's tape action. So Eric, when we talk about the S&P 500, we're now on the sixth day of a pullback that's about 40 points off of their highs. What's your feeling about the S&P 500 here?
Well, you know, what's fascinating to me is a lot of people are calling this a blow-off top. They're, you know, calling the top. They're saying the beginning of the bear market is now and so forth. And I say, based on what? You know, you can't say that the top is in because valuations are higher than they should be as dictated by fundamentals, because frankly, that's been true for a couple of years as far as I'm concerned. The way blow-off tops work is, generally speaking, you get crazy amounts of momentum to the upside because people are just not thinking straight. You know, the classic sign is the Time magazine cover that says stocks can never go down. You know, that's when the top is really in. We haven't gotten to that point yet. So this could be the top. This could be the end. I certainly think this has gone on much longer than it should have. But I see no reason to come to that conclusion that it's over yet. I'm still on the sidelines. I don't want to be long, but I don't dare to be short yet.
Now let's talk about that U.S. dollar index. We continue to pivot around this 102 handle, and obviously Mario Draghi and his comments this morning caused a little bit of volatility in the dollar. Do you think we still break out here?
Yeah, I think we do. You know, we had the pullback below 101 spot 50 on Janet Yellen last week. Basically, I think that was a sell the news event when she pretty much confirmed that there's going to be a rate hike next week. There's no more data to come in to make the rate hike more likely. So I think that was a sell the news event. The pullback lasted a couple days. We're back above a 102 again. We're just 102 spot 04 as we're speaking around 11 a.m. on Thursday. We saw 102 spot 27 overnight last night. So, you know, I still want to see something north of 103 spot 81, which was the previous cycle high, in order to seal the deal in my mind that the bull market rally is on. I do think that there are a lot of very smart people that are coming out with a bearish view. And in my opinion, the way to think about this is it's entirely about the difference between what Donald Trump wants and needs versus what his policies will get him. Mr. Trump very clearly understands that he needs a weaker U.S. dollar in order to achieve all of his goals. He knows that. He's said it publicly. He wants a weaker U.S. dollar. But the policies that he's actually pressing of repatriating assets, corporate assets, and so forth are all dollar bullish. So you can either think of it as the policies are dollar bullish. That means we're going to see a continuing rally. That's been the view that I've taken. Or you can take the view, which is sooner or later, Mr. Trump is going to find a way to arrest the ascent of the dollar and contain this rally because he needs to in order to achieve his goals. I think that's probably true, but I don't think we're there yet because I haven't seen any signs of policy that would say that. So I'm watching very closely. I'm listening to what the president says when he talks about actually doing something that's going to arrest the rally rather than just wishing for it to stop going up. Then my view will change at that point. But right now, I think that the rally is intact.
Well, thanks for that. Now, I really want to get to oil. Now, for weeks, you've been bearish on oil. You've been looking for that breakdown to happen down toward the $45 level. And boom, oil over the last 2 days has broken down significantly, trading now around that 49 handle. Oil is the subject of today's podcast. But is there something you wanted to touch on before the interview?
Well, I want to leave most of it for Art Berman because he's obviously the expert here. Let's just quickly review the inventory numbers. We saw a build of 8.2 million barrels of crude oil, about 867,000 barrel build in Cushing, Oklahoma. But you know what? That was against drawdowns in finished products inventories, 6.6 million barrels gasoline drawdown, distillates 2.7 million barrel drawdown. So really, you know, yeah, 8.2 million barrels is a huge build in inventories and it's bearish data. But actually, the very first reaction to that data print was to the upside in crude oil prices because the gasoline and distillate drawdowns were so large. But then I guess reality set in. But you know what? You know, this 8.2 million barrels, we had 13 million barrels a couple of weeks ago. That didn't do it. So why is it suddenly now that reality is sinking in and people are recognizing that this narrative about a rebalancing and storage being drawn down and so forth is not really happening? I guess they've just finally come to their senses. I'm not sure, but I don't see any other catalyst. Aside from that, let's save the rest of the oil conversation for Art Berman. He's got a lot to say on a whole number of different facets of this.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to that. Now, let's touch on gold here. Obviously, in the face of that U.S. dollar strength, gold continues to correct lower, now almost teasing around this 1,200 level. Do we see a break of gold below 1,200 here?
I think that we will, and of course, the real tell is going to be the dollar index. If we see the dollar index move north of 103.81, the previous cycle high, that tells me that the dollar rally is strongly intact. I would consider even shorting gold at that point. Right now, what we're seeing is some round number support at 1,200. We're looking at 1,202 spot 70 as we're speaking on Thursday morning. I wouldn't be surprised if it kind of bounces off 1,200 once or twice more, but I think it is eventually going below 1,200. Be very interesting to see if we get back down to 1,124, which was the previous cycle low. Again, what would change all of this? A geopolitical upset is always possible that can send gold to the moon. If there was some kind of a Plaza Accord 2.0 where the dollar rally is going to be contained by publicly announced policy or there's intimations that that's coming, gold goes through the roof at that point to the upside. But if those things don't happen, I think we're going to see continued weakness in gold.
Now let's touch on interest rates and yields. Obviously, with suddenly the March meeting going live, almost all yields have suddenly jumped, including now the 10-year yield decisively above the 2.5 level, now hitting around the 2.58 level. What's your feeling on bonds here?
Well, you know, we still haven't crossed any of the red lines that the people like Bill Gross said, you know, would close above 260. Gundlach said above 3% would be where the 10-year is signaling a major trend change. Even Jeff Gundlach himself said he expects the 10-year yield to drop back down below 2.25% before eventually we move to higher yields. So, you know, I don't think it's over. I still think we're treading water here. And I think that the really big strategic trade is the short on treasuries. And I don't think you put that on until we get maybe to the depths of the next recession when you might see either a retest of that 135 level or even a lower yield than that. As far as right now, I'm just watching it.
Thanks for the market update, Eric. Petroleum geologist Art Berman is back as this week's featured guest. After the interview, Eric and I will be back to continue last week's discussion on options writing in a portfolio as an asset class. We recommend that you download the book of charts and graphs that Art has sent us. You'll find the link in this week's Research Roundup email. If you have not yet registered, go to the macrovoices.com website and look for instructions in the write-up of this week's episode. I will instruct you on how to register. Eric's interview with Art Berman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Art sent us a fantastic slide deck to accompany today's interview, so I strongly recommend that you download that. Patrick told you before the interview where to find it. Art, thanks so much for joining us today. You know, I want to start with the big picture before we get into your slide deck, which is you and I both predicted this down move in crude oil. Just last week on this program, I said I thought we were headed towards 45. But, you know, I have to question myself and say, why now specifically? Because, you know, yesterday we did see a significant build on crude oil inventory, but it was offset by drawdowns in finished products. And frankly, even the build wasn't nearly as big as we had a few weeks ago. So is there another catalyst in play, or why is it that suddenly we're being proven right on this?
Right, Eric. Well, I agree with what you just said. And more than anything, I think it's just a failure of confidence in the ability of OPEC to deliver on the cut. I mean, the production cut. I mean, the market has been buoyed up by hope, expectation, first of a freeze, then of a cut. You know, we had lots of ups and downs in the earlier part of 2016 as, you know, as hopes increased and then faded. And we can talk about all the technical factors that affect oil prices, and we will talk about many of those before we're done with this discussion. But I think more than anything, people are just starting to really question, first, whether OPEC can deliver on the cuts that it's announced, and secondly, whether those cuts, even if they are successful, will they last long enough, or will they be offset by increases in production from places like, you know, Libya, Nigeria, and U.S. tight oil?
Let's go ahead and get into your slide deck. Something that just blows my mind, Art. I talk to people in the industry, people who ought to know better, and they'll say, yeah, you know, crude oil inventories are really high, but they're not nearly as high as they were last year, you know, when we had the low oil prices. That's just plain wrong. I mean, we are at all-time record highs, way higher than last year. So what's going on here on slide two? Walk us through this.
Yeah, slide two just shows U.S. crude oil inventories. Later on in this deck, I'll show OECD, but you know, the developed countries of the world. But U.S. shows the problem, and the problem is that 2015 levels of storage were all-time record highs compared to any previous year. I show the four previous years, 2011 through 14. 2016 was even higher than 2015, and 2017 is even higher than both of those. I mean, you just can't make that go away. It's plain as day. There's no interpretation in this chart whatsoever.
And this is all government-supplied data. So it's definitely striking to me that, you know, a year ago we're looking at $26 oil because everybody was afraid of a storage crisis. Now that we've got much more oil in storage, less available capacity. Has there been a huge increase in storage capacity over the last year that might explain why there's less sensitivity to the risk of running out of space?
Well, there have been incremental increases in capacity, but mainly they're just moving it around. And as you and I have discussed before, for lots of reasons that are hard to pin down, when Cushing is approaching 88, 89, 90% capacity, that's when prices go berserk. And I think what's happened is that the ability to move inventories around out of Cushing and probably more into Gulf Coast, which has more room, has become more efficient over the last year. And so we're, you know, even though we've got a lot, you know, we've got more oil in storage, it's not so much focused on the Cushing tanks.
And we should mention, for the benefit of our listeners who may not realize it, that Cushing, Oklahoma is the settlement point for the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures Contract. So the available capacity in Cushing, Oklahoma definitely plays a critical role. And as you say, there has been an increase in the pipeline capacity out of Cushing down to the Gulf Coast. So as Cushing starts to overflow, they have more ability to contend with that problem than they used to. But still, we see these inventories on the rise. Let's move move on to slide three. And I think we should start, for people who have not heard your previous interviews, explaining what you mean by comparative inventory, comparison of what to what, and why is seasonality so important to understand when you're evaluating the crude oil market?
Good, Eric. And my very strong sense and bias is that crude oil inventory is by far the most important single thing that you can look at if you want to understand price and try to divine or predict, you know, where it might be going. So comparative inventory simply takes the inventory that we have today and compares it with a moving average of inventories for the same week over the last 5 years. That's all it is. It's a fairly simple concept. But what that does is it indexes how anomalous or how normal or how subnormal the current build or withdrawal is compared to what's gone on last year and over the past 5 years at the same date. So, for instance, if refineries are going through seasonal maintenance, you're comparing likes with likes. You're comparing an inventory increase or decrease during maintenance with what happened in years when those refineries were also going through maintenance. And so it normalizes the way that we think about inventory changes. So what this chart shows then is it's just a cross plot of WTI spot price on the y-axis and comparative inventory, which is again current inventory minus the five-year average of past inventories. That's all it is, comparative inventory. And what we see is that there are very nicely behaved trends that we can plot through those points. And I'm showing 3 years worth of data, 2014 through 17, and I'm also showing some points up around 2006 and 7. I could show lots more, but it would confuse the graph. The point is that there is a trend line, and you can think of that as a yield curve if you like. And what it says is that based on that trend line, WTI is, well, when it was at $54 or $55 a day or so ago, was about $6 or $7 overvalued. Even today, it's trading at, the futures are trading at a little below 50 at the moment. We're still probably $3 overvalued. What's the cause of that overvaluation? Well, it's mainly expectation that somehow this OPEC deus ex machina is going to, you know, resolve all the problems of oversupply and demand and everything else we talk about in the world. So, but again, you know, if we go and we look at this graph and say, well, okay, what do comparative inventories have to do to get us to $70? And $70 just happens to be where this trend line intersects the y-axis. And the answer is comparative inventory needs to fall 170 million barrels from where it is right now.
And if we look at this chart, there's really no sign of a reversal of trend here. We're seeing all these red dots moving further and further to the right on the chart. These are 1 week represented, each weekly inventory report, by a dot on the chart. So if I see just a couple of signs of a pullback in one or two dots, that just tells me 2 weeks worth of data were starting to go in a direction that might have supported higher prices. That's not even close to a trend. So we haven't really seen anything that would tell us that a secular reversal of price trend should be occurring here based on this data.
Not at all. If anything, the straight line of points that sits just below the $54 marker on that graph, it's been moving pretty much to the right, which is the wrong direction, over the last 2 months, basically. So, 1 week it might move a little bit in the right direction, but still, the thing to keep in mind, and this chart is hardly dogma, but what is, I think, dogma is if we don't start making some serious reductions in inventory and comparative inventory, there's just no way that we're going to get to $70 oil. I don't know who made that number up, but you can't just magically get someplace. You have to do something first. You have to reduce your inventory, and that's the bottom line. And we're just not seeing it yet. And when we see it, I'll be the first to cheer. Look, I drill wells. That's what I do for a living. And nobody would like to see higher oil prices than Art Berman, because it would be great for Art Berman's bank account if we had higher oil prices. But I have to tell the truth. I mean, if the signs look negative based on technical information, market data, that's what I got to say. So I'm not a pessimist. That's just what the data tells me.
Well, you know, it's fascinating to me that so many people who ought to know better are focused on a rebalancing of production with consumption, and they're not looking at the amount of oil in storage. And if you look at the term structure of the crude oil futures contracts, you know, they're showing backwardation. Until very recently, there was backwardation just 6 months out on the curve. And that would suggest that 6 months out, there's going to be no need for storage. You know, how could that possibly be if you're looking at a chart like this? So it blows my mind that there was quite a few hedge funds that were betting on developing backwardation as close as the June to December spread in 2017. And that just doesn't make sense based on this data. So I guess the question it begs for me, though, is I see these dots here moving further and further to the right. We're already well to the right of where we were when we saw $26 oil prices. So does that mean that you think we're headed back to $26 or below, or are we going to stay up here around this black long-term trend line, or are we going to overshoot it? What do you think comes next?
Well, and obviously no one knows the answer to that question, but what this comparative inventory methodology allows me to do is to I can systematically see where things are going from week to week. So there aren't any big surprises that happen here. I mean, there's no physical way that we're going to, you know, reduce 50 million barrels of comparative inventory in 1 week and all of a sudden everything shoots way to the right. That's just, you know, beyond the capacity of the physical system. And so what this tells me is that if there is a correct price, the correct price is somewhere around $45 a barrel. I think that the $26 a barrel was overshoot in the wrong direction. I mean, it was clearly below the trend line. We were being dragged down in late 2015, early 2016, by all kinds of issues that related mostly to sentiment about pessimism about the global economy, you know, the stock market in China was going down the drain, and the euro and the European Union seemed to be collapsing with the potential exit of Greece, and demand growth for oil was very, very low at that time. And so, you know, those are all real factors and they all affect price, but none of them actually have very much to do with why prices got to $26. So that was an overshoot in the wrong direction. I think what we're seeing right now is not as severe of an overshoot in the upward direction, but definitely an overshoot. So to me, what the OPEC production cut does is it pretty much puts a floor under oil prices, at least as long as there's some reason to expect that there are going to be cuts of some sort, and I think you know we have reason to see that. So it would surprise me if prices got below $40, just to throw a number out there. As soon as I say that, I'm probably wrong, but that, you know, it would surprise me. I think the OPEC cuts probably put a floor of 40 under things. There could be some very negative political or economic events that might cause it to go below that, but that's what I think. So 45, I think, is the right number. Anywhere between where we were a day or so ago and 40 wouldn't surprise me. Below 40 would surprise me. But it's possible.
As I look at page 4 in your slide deck here, I have to wonder, it's showing essentially that the surplus of production over consumption, P peaked a little over a year ago, around the beginning of 2016, and it's
Correct.
Begun to decline since then. So you would think that if that surplus is decreasing, and I think maybe this is the translation people make incorrectly, is they think decreasing surplus, and they think that that means decreasing amount of oil in storage and inventory. What it really means is the rate at which the increasing storage is going out of hand is slowing, but it is still moving further to the right. So how does that fit in here, and is this decreasing surplus eventually going to get to a deficit? And how long do you think that we are away from that? When we get to a deficit, would you think that we see a rapid drawdown, or is it going to take years to work off all this excess inventory?
That's a great question. And of course, again, I don't know, but let's just look at the recent month. So this is EIA data that just came out a couple of days ago. And what it says is that the production minus consumption balance, which is what's being shown here, is about 1 million barrels negative as of February. Okay, so let's just say that it remains 1 million barrels negative for, you know, forever. And what we're looking at is we need to reduce OECD inventories by about 500 million barrels to, you know, to get to something that might support $70 oil prices, and we need to move U.S. inventories down, you know, something like 100 or 120. So what you're talking about, depending on, you know, how you index this thing, is you're probably talking about at least a year, you know, just doing the division, and maybe more. But, you know, so the 500 and 550 of OECD at a million a day is, you know, you're talking about a year and a half or so, maybe a little bit less for U.S. So the point is, as I said before, is you just don't make step changes in inventory levels overnight. It just doesn't happen. And so I think that the expectation is, oh, great, OPEC's going to cut, and so we're going to be good in a matter of time. Well, some matter of time, yes, I agree with that completely. That was a hugely positive thing, don't get me wrong. But it's a slow process, like everything is in the world. And the, you know, to hammer home the point, inventory is part of supply. It's like your savings account. You got a checking account and you got a savings account. Inventory is your savings account. And if you happen to, you know, write too many checks and you're overdrafted in your checking account, all you need to do is transfer some money out of savings into checking and you're good. Okay? And so what this says is that if the production consumption balance remains negative, you're going to be making withdrawals from your savings account on a regular basis, and that's what's going to draw down inventory. But because inventory is so high, it's going to take a while. It's that simple, I think.
Well, and there's, I think it's important to emphasize that there's no reason to assume that this decreasing surplus is going to keep decreasing or go into deficit, because if you look at another chart, which we don't have in this particular deck, but if you look at the graph of the rig count and you lag that by several months and look at U.S. production, there's a very, very strong correlation there. So we know from a predictive standpoint, if you look at the last 3 to 6 months of increase in rig count, we know U.S. production is going to increase. And right, that's going to create a headwind for this decreasing surplus to decrease too much further. So, you know, the idea that the market's about to rebalance and everything's hunky-dory by the end of 2017, which is the narrative that seemed to be driving this $55 oil price, it never made sense. And the data has been really clear all along.
I agree with you. I mean, there are scenarios by which it could occur, but they are low probability scenarios in my view. And all you have to do is look at this chart, Eric, and you go back as recently as August, September of 2016, and we had negative production consumption balances then too. In fact, in August, we had 1.5 million barrels of negative. Okay, well, that didn't last very long, and pretty soon we were right back above the line at you know, at $1 million, $1.2 million. So, you know, these are the, you know, this is what happens as the waves of production come into play. So we're looking at one data point is what we're looking at right now. We got 1 month of positive data. If we have 2 months, that's still not a trend, but it's more encouraging than one. If we get 3 months, then I'm going to start to say, wow, we might be seeing the beginning of a trend. But like all of these things, they evolve kind of slowly.
On this next chart, I see that we're seeing an increase in annual consumption growth. And I just want to weigh that against, I think IEA recently had made a forecast. Now, we're looking on slide 5 here at historical data. I believe IEA's forecast was that this would move in the other direction, that we would actually see a reduction in the rate of consumption growth over the next year. Is that correct? And how does that play into what we're seeing on this chart?
Yeah, IEA and many other groups are looking out kind of longer term, and we've seen some pretty impressive consumption growth, which by the way is slightly different than demand growth, but let's not get into that right now. But so early in 2016, everybody like EIA, IEA was very pessimistic, and they were saying to you, if we're lucky, we might get up to 1.2 million barrels a day of growth. And as recently as mid-year, that was kind of the view. And then we had some very strong months. August was a super strong month. September, October were pretty good. November was ultra strong. And so that lifted the average for the year to 1.5. And then the first 2 months of 16 are really high. I mean, we're up to 1.6. But to put that in perspective, the average since the financial collapse is 1.6. So we've just clawed our way back to the average for the last 7 or 8 years, which isn't bad, but, you know, it's nothing to celebrate either. The problem, though, going forward, and this is what you're referring to, is that IEA sees demand weakening into the coming year and continuing to weaken going forward over the next several years. And that's due to all kinds of factors, the ongoing weakness of the global economy, plus the headwinds against using fossil fuels and all of the climate change initiatives and et cetera. And those are definitely part of some kind of long-term trend. I don't doubt that data is notionally correct. I think that the calls for peak demand are way premature. I think we're going to be very dependent on oil particularly, but fossil fuels in general for a long time to come, although I'm all in favor of, you know, let's move to other sources as quickly as we can. It's, again, it all takes time. This is a big super tanker we're talking about here, and you don't make quick turns.
As we continue to look at the last couple of slides, of course, we're looking at global data, whereas the first few only looked at U.S. data. And slide 6, we're looking at a comparison of the U.S. inventory picture, comparing that to the rest of the OECD. What is this slide telling you? What's the story here?
Okay, Eric, this is an incremental chart. And so what I've done here is I'm looking at OECD, and I've subtracted U.S. to separate it from the rest of OECD because it's the biggest single component, of course. And all I'm doing here is I'm saying how much has the inventory grown since December of 2013. So there's the bottom of the chart is base, okay, and that's a very big number. That's like, 2.6 billion. So I'm just showing the change. That's what this thing shows. And so what it shows is that total OECD minus U.S. plus U.S. has been growing like a son of a gun since December of 2013. And it was that inventory growth that really set off the financial collapse or the oil price collapse, that we started growing inventory beginning really in January of 14, and it took until June of 14 before the market started paying attention and saying, wow, maybe we have a problem here, and prices leveled off and declined a little bit below. Brent was 110 at the time. And it took a couple of more months before the market really digested all of this and said, wow, we're in trouble. And so beginning in September, you know, we were way, way up this curve. And so prices and inventories have a beautiful negative correlation. So like I started this discussion, inventory. You want to know where prices are going, look at inventory. And if inventories are building or not falling and they're high, then you're stuck with lower prices for a while.
Now, page 7 is showing us U.S. crude oil production forecasts, and it basically says here that EIA is projecting that by the end of 2018, we will be at an all-time high, higher than the 1970s in U.S. production at 10.1 million barrels per day, and they're saying $59 WTI by then. So how does that view of EIA relate to your views? Do you think they've got the story right, or is there more to this picture than they're telling us?
Well, I think EIA does a pretty good job on short-term forecasts and maybe not such a good job on longer-term forecasts, but then who does? So I think EIA's, you know, these forecasts they've made over the past couple of years that I've been following them closely have been pretty good. And do I believe that we're going to exceed 10 million barrels a day? That would surprise me. But, you know, might we get back to, you know, 9.6, 9.7 where we were in April of 15? Sure, we might. And might we maintain a plateau there? Yeah, sure, we might. The price forecast, though, Eric, I think is more interesting than the actual production numbers. So, I mean, what EIA is saying here is that their fairly sophisticated modeling, which could be wrong, is saying we're not going to get to $60 for 2 years at least. And whether we believe that or not, I think we have to take it seriously. I mean, here is an anchor against all of this hope and expectation where so many people would say, oh, we'll be at 60 by the end of 2017, no problem. And surely by the end of 2018, well, you know, here's one of the two largest monitoring and reporting agencies in the world saying, you know, we don't think so. But let's go back and recall that of all of the single superficial causes of the oil price collapse of 2014, it was U.S. crude oil production growth, mainly from tight oil. I mean, that production increase was almost 4.5 million barrels a day over just a couple of years. That's what broke the system. Now, there's a flip side to this, and the flip side is that because of all of the dislocation in the U.S. oil field services industry, we can drill all the wells we want, and we're drilling a lot of wells right now. The rig count's gone way up, but we don't have the capacity that we used to for the frac crews, the completion crews, that are needed to convert that drilling into production. So I'm sure that EIA knows about that and is thinking about it, but I don't know that very many other people are. So U.S. production growth is not a strict function of rig count. It's rig count plus the ability to convert that drilling into production, and that takes frac crews. That takes pressure pumping.
You know, Art, the thing that fascinates me is there was so much focus in the press and everybody's eyes were on the OPEC compliance. They said they were going to cut 1.8 million barrels. Would they really do it? Would they do it? Would they do it? Would they? Nobody was paying attention to Libya and other producers announcing increases in production, which I think if you add them together might completely, you know, make up for whatever OPEC was going to do. So give us the picture of, you know, aside from the OPEC cut that everybody focused on, what else has been going on in terms of global production in the same time period?
Well, as you know, Nigeria and Libya were exempted from the OPEC cut because those countries have seen severe reductions in oil production because of civil unrest and related issues. So they were exempted. And And so what's happened is that in Nigeria, the main reason for the supply disruptions were that the government, they got a new government there, relatively new, that stopped paying off the rebels in the Niger Delta. The rebels went berserk and blew up a lot of pipelines and a lot of oil production facilities. And so recently, the government has decided it's probably a pretty good idea if we pay these guys again. Okay, so Nigerian production is increasing and has a good chance to increase back to a much higher level. In Libya, there's a general who's been quite successfully retaking a lot of the refinery cities and the export terminals. And so Libyan production has been going up. And so I wouldn't say that nobody's been paying attention to it, but the broader market has not been paying that much attention to it. So on the plus side of the equation, there's certainly Libya, Nigeria, and the U.S. that we've already talked about. Iran is, continues despite agreements. They're somewhat exempted from the agreement, not totally. They've increased. Is Iraq complying? Iraq needs money for a lot of reasons, but to fight ISIS. And so there's just an awful lot of unknowns in the equation. On the negative side is Venezuela. You know, Venezuela is about as close to a failed state as you're going to get. And things are getting worse there and not better. And, so on the deficit side, we could see decreasing production from Venezuela. In short, Eric, I mean, the world is a hugely complex, interlocking puzzle of pluses and minuses, and every country is doing what it sees as totally rational for its own purposes. Taken as a whole, it might look totally nuts. And so to try to imagine that because OPEC and Russia and a few others have joined together and said, okay, we're going to cut. Well, that first of all, we all have doubts as to whether they're going to actually do that to the extent they say they do. But even if they do, that's not the whole world. The world is complicated, and there's lots of opportunities for ups and downs in production.
Now, Venezuela is almost completely out of money. I read at least one article that said they're down to their last $10 billion of reserves for the entire country. So what happens when they run out? This is the classic creditor problem of the foreign contractors that are producing oil for them. If they say, hey, if you don't pay us, we're going to pull out, then that guarantees they'll never be able to pay them. So do you think that the foreign contractors will kind of keep working on credit and keep producing oil? Or is there a risk of a sudden, complete cessation of Venezuelan production?
Yeah, good question, and I wish I knew the answer, but I don't. My sense is, like with many or most things in the world, I tend to minimize the likelihood of sudden events. You think about Venezuela as not exactly a paragon of high integrity government or economic functioning. And so if the only source of income is oil, or one of the only significant sources of income is oil, no matter how bad things get, there are probably selfish people that are going to somehow figure out how to keep some amount of production going. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you got to pay people, and I don't know where it can go. I'm not looking for Venezuelan production to drop to zero, just because somebody will figure out how to make the money. How they pay those guys, I don't know. It's not the first time. By far, it's not the first time that contractors and other oil companies operating in that country haven't been paid.
Let's come back to the United States, because something that I'm very curious to get an update on is, it seems like, and as we went through the worst of the glut, everybody sort of lost track of everything but the Permian Basin in terms of shale plays in the United States. The Permian was economic to continue drilling and, you know, making new wells and so forth, even at the bottom of oil prices. But they pretty much stopped in the Bakken, and I don't know if that's begun again. So let's go through the major shale plays, the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, and so forth. Are they starting to drill again there? How does it look? I know that you had a blog post describing how the Bakken may be in a state of permanent decline. What's the story there? Give us the update on U.S. shale and what the picture looks like.
Yeah, sure. So the three major plays are Bakken, Eagle Ford, and Permian. And, you know, to take your last point first, I just recently did a bottoms-up, very detailed analysis of the Bakken. And the Bakken isn't over by a long shot, but what my study revealed is that it is clearly showing signs of depletion. And you can read my post if you want the details. But the bottom line is that the downside of all of this technology and efficiency that we, you know, hear so much positive about is that it accelerates the decline of your resource. And so what I think has happened in the Bakken is that we've reached or exceeded the maximum well spacing needed to drain the reservoir. So production has declined. A lot of that's because of price, but a lot of it is because of the fact that the wells are simply interfering with each other. The reserves for each successive year of new wells brought on has been going down every year. And they're, you know, they're drilling in all the best places. So that just says that, well, that's because wells are they're stealing production from each other. They're drilled too close together, given all this fantastic technology. So no, the Bakken's going to be with us for 10 or 20 years. It's just I don't think that there's any amount of drilling that's going to get it back to whatever its peak was of 1.1 or 1.2 million barrels a day. It's just physics. I mean, this happens to all oil fields. There's nothing special about tight oil or shale that exempts it from the laws of physics. But to your other point, so the other two plays, the Eagle Ford and the Permian gets all the press. And so since mid-September, which was really when it became probable that OPEC was going to do something, we added over 100 rigs in the Permian Basin, like a 62% increase. That clearly overshadows the other two plays, but let's not minimize them. The Bakken has increased by 12 rigs since then. That's almost a 50% increase because it was down to 26. And the Eagle Ford has increased by 30, okay? So, you know, that's a pretty substantial increase as well. So not as impressive as the Permian in terms of total rigs or percentage growth, but pretty darn notable, let's put it that way. So I guess the next question is, well, you know, are these the only plays that there are? Is somebody about to hatch the next Permian Basin play on us? Well, first of all, the Permian Basin is really three tight oil plays in one. I won't get into the details of those. I've got blog posts on them if you want to read them. But so far, at least, the answer to that seems to be somewhere between no and maybe. EOG Resources has done a lot of work in a play called the Buda, which is B-U-D-A, in East Texas. And by the amount of money they're spending up there, could this have the potential to be another Eagle Ford or Bakken? Maybe, but we don't know. Beyond that, though, no. I think this idea that because shale is everywhere that we're going to somehow have some infinite amount of new production. Not all shale is equal, and it has to be at the right depth, and a lot of other technical factors. So I would say that for the time being, if there's maybe one more tight oil play out there over the next, 5 years or so that's significant, to me that would be a lot. And the Buda play of EOGs is far from proven. They've drilled a couple of wells. But the Permian, the reason that it's so attractive is that there's a lot of room to run with it. There, these tight oil plays out there, two of the three in particular, they're not very densely drilled yet, and so there's a lot of locations that can still be drilled, and that could mean significant production growth. The Permian has never declined through all of this oil price collapse. Production continues to grow in those tight oil plays in the Permian.
I want to move on to another question. Let's just hypothetically consider the possibility that President Trump's policies so far have been very much, focus on America first and so forth. What if the Trump administration were to announce, okay, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to intentionally implement policies, import taxes and so forth, that will be designed to create a major renaissance in U.S. oil production. We're going to support the American oil industry, and we're going to do that by making it more expensive to use imported oil. We're going to, do everything that we can to promote the growth and expansion of the U.S. oil industry. If President Trump were to do that, is the industry ready to ramp up and, go into super production mode, or are there challenges that would maybe make that difficult? And if so, what are those challenges?
The key challenge, Eric, is that the composition of U.S. oil and U.S. tight oil in particular is very peculiar. It's what we call ultra-light sweet oil. It is very, very light. It's almost some of it in a gasoline phase when it comes out of the ground. And that's kind of a good thing, because you don't have to, you don't have to do a lot of fancy processing or refining on it to get it into the products that you can sell to make money. The downside of that is that about 30 years ago, when U.S. oil production was in serious decline, the refining industry re-engineered all of its refineries for much heavier oil, because that was the dominant supply in the world, as it is still today. And so suddenly we have this renaissance of new U.S. production that all happens to be super, super light, and we don't have the refinery capacity to do anything with it unless we blend it. We blend it with heavier grades of crude oil, so that then the blended mixture is right for our refineries, and then we're okay. Well, where does that heavier oil come from? Well, most of it is imported, okay? We get a lot of heavier oil from Saudi Arabia. We get a lot of heavier oil from Canada. We get it from Venezuela. We get it from Mexico. So if you cut off the imports of the heavier oil, then you can produce all you want, and you just throw it into storage because you can't refine it. And you can't export that much of it either, because nobody else really knows what to do with it.
Let's suppose that Mr. Trump were able to recognize that and maybe organize things in order to support the growth of the U.S. industry by allowing the tax-free import of the heavy oil needed for blends, but not, as principal stock. Is the industry ready in terms of the equipment and facilities that it needs to ramp up significantly if the economics were there, or are there other challenges in terms of the readiness of the drilling equipment and so forth?
Okay, well, first thing, we don't import anything but heavier oil these days. So, there's no cut that he can make and say, well, we'll take your heavy oil, but we're going to cut off everybody else who has lighter oil. We stopped importing light oil when we made this big step forward with tight oil. We've done all the substitution we can. That's why U.S. imports have declined. We simply substituted imported light oil with our own oil. But to your question, is the industry ready? I don't think they are. We've seen a significant increase in rig count, but we're still nowhere close to where we were before the price collapse. And the oil field services industry, the drillers, and all of the industries that support the drilling, to ramp up to a point that, if you want to make the U.S. more self-reliant on domestic supply, that's a real, real stretch. And then as I've already described, the ability to to do the fracs, the pressure pumping, to convert the drilling to production, we're looking at, I mean, that industry, that part of the industry is a disaster. I mean, they, you know, the state of their equipment that has deferred maintenance, cannibalized parts. I mean, I've heard knowledgeable people tell me that if we started spending a lot of money today, and we haven't yet, that it might take a year and a half or two to get that capacity back up to where it was in 2014. So those are some real, you know, some real challenges to ramping up production. The other thing I need to remind people, this idea that the U.S. can be energy independent is just the most ridiculous idea in the world. I mean, we import almost 7.5 million barrels of crude oil a day. We import pretty nearly half. And there's nothing wrong with being dependent on other people. I mean, you know, we're not self-supplying with coffee, and nobody complains about importing coffee from, you know, Colombia or Africa or wherever. That's the nature of trade. But for the United States to be 100% oil self-sufficient, I just don't think it'll happen when we stop using oil. But as long as we rely on oil as our principal source of primary energy, it ain't going to happen.
I want to move on to more of a technical trading topic. I know that's a little bit outside your field, but I want to get your perspective on it anyway, which is we now have just hit, and it's come down a little bit in the last week or two, but we just recently hit an all-time record speculative long interest in crude oil futures. So that means that speculators, hedge funds primarily, are more long as measured in barrels than they've ever been before, including 2014. But there's another side to that argument that some people have posited to say, wait a minute, if you measure it in barrels, that's true. But if you measure it in dollars, we're nowhere close to as much long interest in terms of dollars at risk as we were in 2014. And that means that, you know, we could go back to the same amount of dollar risk. And if we did, you know, that would be even more. I can't really decide how to play this out. What's more important? Because the number of barrels, that's really what translates directly to the number of days of supply of production or of consumption or what have you. But the amount of dollars probably is a better measure of the capacity of Wall Street to make the wrong bets, potentially. Do you have a view on this? What's important? And what do you think this record long interest means? To me, it's a sign of excessive speculation, and probably all the ingredients are there for a big unwind and a major price correction to the downside, which may very well be upon us. Do you think that's true, or how do you see this?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I go back to history, Eric, and if you look at those you know, those long positions back over the last, let's say, 10 years, just about every time that we get to a peak in those long positions, that precedes a big price drop. So that's a purely empirical observation, but I mean, you know, for instance, in early 2011, we reached a peak in net long positions, and oil prices went from $112 down to $80. In 2014, that was you just discussed that, but in terms of total contracts, that was very close, but second to the recent peak. And what happened there was that prices went from $105 a barrel down to, you know, $44 a barrel. We had a price rally in early 2015 where prices got up to $60. There were record long positions. Prices went from $60 first to 41 and eventually down to 26. So if history is a guide, then these record long positions ought to be viewed very suspiciously as often an overshot before we see a price collapse or a big drop in prices.
And it's entirely possible that that could be honest. An interesting statistic, as we've been recording this interview on Thursday morning, when we began speaking, Art, oil was trading above $50, about 50.09. It's moved down more than a dollar just in the time that we've been speaking, touching 49 briefly and 49.07 as I look at my screen right now. So who knows? Maybe the unwind of that long position has begun. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to mention to anybody who doesn't already subscribe, you write a fantastic blog at artberman.com. It's free. There's no advertising. The content is fantastic. Listeners, if you are not subscribing to Art's blog and you're at all interested in this market, you're not acting rationally. You want to subscribe to Art's blog. It's absolutely excellent. And that is free at artberman.com. Let's talk, though, about what's not free, because we do have a significant institutional following in our audience. What do you do at Labyrinth Consulting? I know that you're involved in drilling oil rigs, but you also provide services to investors. Give us the rundown of what business you're in.
Yeah, very quickly. I mean, I've shown you, I can tell you an awful lot about where price trends are probably going, and I've got some, you know, some really good help on that from other parties. You want consulting on, you know, what companies you ought to have in your portfolio or take out of your portfolio. You know, I can do very accurate assessments of, you know, what's the underlying asset of this company and how much does it really cost them to produce the oil? What's their real break-even price? And, you know, are they telling you the truth when they say that they can, you know, break even at $40 or $35 a barrel? So basically valuations and investment decisions. I'm not an investment advisor, but I can tell you what the data says about the strength of a company or an investment. That's what I do.
Well, unfortunately, we are up against our hard limit in terms of time. So thank you so much, Art, for another fantastic interview. We look forward to getting you back on the program in a few months. And Patrick Ceresna and I will be back in just a minute as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it's always great to have Art back on the show periodically to give us great insights into the oil markets. What was your feelings about the interview?
I really enjoyed talking to Art. He's one of my favorite guests. I also want to mention before we move on that we heard from our friends at Real Vision, and they are launching this week their new Adventures in Finance podcast. We don't have enough time because Art went a little bit over time to really go into detail on it. We talked to Grant Williams in last week's show, so be sure to check that out. You can find it on iTunes. Just search for Adventures in Finance. And they tell us they're going to do something new and exciting in the podcast space, so I'll be curious to see how it comes out. Last week, though, we started on the topic of treating option writing as an asset class. And because we were limited on time, we could only get into the topic of covered call writing. I want to move into other strategies, but before we do that, we got a question from a listener, so I want to read that. Our listener writes, I think we need to be sure to advise listeners as to what to do if price falls below your cost basis plus the net premium collected and price is in decline. How do you manage that sort of situation? Do you roll? Do you close both the call? What do you do? In other words, let me simplify the question maybe for the benefit of some listeners who don't have as much experience as this particular listener does. What he's basically saying is, suppose that you buy a stock because you think having that stock in your portfolio is a good idea. You think the price is going to go up. Then you write an out-of-the-money covered call option in order to generate a little bit more profit. But you're still expecting the stock to go up. Stock doesn't go up. It goes down. So now that means that you're profiting from the call if the stock price is going down because you're short the call. But you're also holding a stock that maybe you don't want to hold anymore. So if you get to the point where you want to take that stock out of your portfolio, if you just sold the stock, that would leave you with a naked short call, which is a very risky position. So what do you do in that? How do you manage risk in that situation, I think, is the summary of this listener's question.
Well, Eric, that's a great question. And I just want to emphasize that it's very important early on for someone to differentiate whether they are an active or a passive manager. Clearly, our listeners referencing an active covered call writing strategy on individual stocks. And so therefore, you have to adapt your style to that. So if you're an active and or leveraged manager and you're, let's say, writing covered calls on high beta momentum names, yeah, you must have a diligent risk management strategy in place. But alternatively, a passive investor that focuses on a basket of low beta value stocks in an unleveraged portfolio is not in any need to exit a trade on the first liquidity event, you know, when a stock drops below your break-even cost base.
So let's talk about an active investor with a technical strategy trading higher beta momentum plays. How would you manage risk in that scenario?
The first cliche answer is diversification, but I personally find that quite unsatisfactory, particularly when it's a pure equity mix, because when the stock markets have a liquidity event, the correlations of all stocks converge to one, and the portfolio will still experience a material drawdown. So like you suggested, a trader actively managing volatile stocks needs to find a technical method that triggers an exit when the trade is blatantly turned against them. Common methods involve watching support levels, which could be a pure price level support, or you could use a more advanced way, something like looking at the volume by price overlay. But once triggered, a trader would simply unwind the position and look for alternatives.
Now, that's obviously an active trader or investor, but correct me if I'm wrong, my sense of what you were describing last week is the spirit of your message around options writing is not really focused on that very active trader.
That's right, Eric. Like, look, we have some very smart and sophisticated listeners that have the ability to do critical thinking and to customize their own methodologies. But it's important to note that when it's done properly, this can be executed very passively within a portfolio with little active management. Some managers simply manage the downside risk by focusing on deep value or on high quality, low beta names. By doing this, they can hold through market corrections without having to actively exit the trade on the first reversal lower. It comes down to a simple question a trader has to ask themselves. Can I create alpha by being active? If you cannot prove that to be the case, then being passive is often much easier. Personally, I find what works is a simple hedging strategy like buying a 10% out of the money S&P 500 put option that blankets the entire option writing portfolio. The cost of the put is absorbed against the enhanced cash flow earned. And you can do this passively and know that you have hedged out the risk of a major bear market liquidity style event.
Okay, thanks so much. I wanted to make sure that we covered that listener question. I want to move on now, and unfortunately, we're running out of time. We were going to talk about selling of puts today, which is a less popular option writing strategy. I think we're going to have to save that for next week because we just don't have time after Art ran a little bit over time today. Give us a quick teaser, though. What are you planning to talk about in terms of put writing in next week's postgame show?
Absolutely, Eric. What I was going to basically touch on is the natural stereotype that comes with put selling is that it's incredibly risky. And I wanted to just really debate the idea of selling puts versus that of covered calls. But you know what? If we're running out of time, let's just actually cover that next week.
Okay, fantastic. We are out of time. So folks, if you want to learn a lot more of this stuff and not have to wait for next week, Patrick is in the business. You won't find a better instructor and mentor than Patrick. So by all means, check out his website at bigpicturetrading.com to learn more about his course offerings on options as well as a number of other trading topics. If you have other questions for the program that you'd like us to cover on the air, send those to requests@macrovoices.com.
All right. Thanks, Eric. Well, is there anything else you wanted to add before we close things up?
We'll keep it tight this week, but you already heard it, folks. You know we really need your help. We're getting some really great guests on the program because of your help. We need to promote the program, so please tell your friends and colleagues about it. Forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. The more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to get the best of the best on the program as featured interview guests. The direct benefit to you is you'll receive our research roundup emails, which is a weekly compendium of all of the cool free stuff that we could find on the internet, including handouts and downloads from our featured interview guests. Patrick, what's in this week's research roundup?
Well, first and foremost, and most importantly, is the transcript for today's interview with Art Berman. As always, though, it takes 24 to 48 hours for that to be uploaded because it takes time to transcribe. But make sure you check it out and read through the entire interview. In addition to that, like Eric highlighted earlier, we have the link for Art Berman's chart book. So that's also in that research roundup. We also have a link for the macro intelligence report on the capital cycle, as well as we have an article discussing David Rosenberg's comment that the Fed is embarking on a path which usually ends in a recession. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the show better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, make sure you email us at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for our most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric directly on Twitter, @EricSTownsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.